Today is Abraham Lincoln's birthday, and we're broadcasting live from our nation's capital, places you know, like the Lincoln Memorial, and some you might not, like President Lincoln's Cottage. Here's its executive director, Aaron Carlston Mast.
When we set out to create the cottage, we thought, well, what's the most important thing about Lincoln's time here? And it's the ideas he created in these spaces.
Plus, we're catching up with members of Illinois' congressional delegation the day after leaders from both parties agreed in principle on a deal to fund the government. We'll be speaking with Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Sean Kasten, and Darren LaHood on whether or not they'll support this deal. Here's Representative Kasten.
In speaking with members who, you know, are in border districts, people like Xochitl Torres-Small, I trust their judgment that there are needs to bolster the wall in some places, but that this is really a more holistic question of saying, how should we deal with this?
All that and more coming up on the 21st from NPR in Washington. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st, and happy birthday, President Lincoln. Today, as we celebrate the life of our 16th president, we also begin our week of broadcasts live from our nation's capital and NPR headquarters. All this hour and this week, we'll be catching up with different members of Illinois' congressional delegation and talking to Illinoisans who live, work, or are visiting Washington. The most famous, no doubt, would be Abraham Lincoln. The Lincoln Memorial is actually one of the most visited national park sites in the country, not just in Washington. Later this hour, we're going to take you to another less-known Lincoln site. That's his cottage. But first, the Lincoln Memorial. I went there yesterday and got a tour. So we're here at the Lincoln Memorial with Heidi Dietz, who is an interpretive park ranger for the National Park Service. So Heidi, you help folks who are coming here understand a little bit more about President Lincoln.
Yes. We get thousands of visitors here every day from all over the world, and they all have a different story that they want to learn about President Lincoln, who he was and what he means today. So I try to help them figure out who Lincoln was and what he can be for each of the visitors.
Is there one thing that you really hope people take away when they come here, regardless of what their background is?
There's so much about Lincoln, so many sides to him and so many elements, and he's so complex, and the time period he lived in was so complex. I guess one of the biggest takeaways that I would love people to take when they leave the memorial is that how much he was for country and how much he was for people. He put himself below country and the unification of country and of people. And so he really put that above all else. You know, he said unity above all. And he really followed that.
Well, I wonder what the most common question is people ask about Abraham Lincoln.
There are a lot of myths about this memorial. Probably the number one myth is that Robert E. Lee is on the back of Lincoln's head here in the chamber. It is not true.
So people come and they look around the
back? Yeah, and like tour guides would say, yeah, Lee's on the back of Lincoln's head, and I'm standing there thinking.
So do you feel like I have to correct this?
Sometimes I do. I can't help myself sometimes. I'm the bad ranger that way.
No, that's the good ranger.
I always ask people then, it's like, why would Lee be on the back of Lincoln's head? Why Lee? It's maybe because just across the river over in Virginia is Lee's old house, which is now in the center of Arlington National Memorial Cemetery. Or what? I don't know. But I always ask them, you tell me, why would Lee be on the back of Lincoln's head? And they can never give me a reason. And so I say, Lee's not on the back of his head. Sorry.
I'm sure that the biggest population of groups that come here are school groups.
Yes.
And school children.
Yes.
And we were talking on this on the way over about our school trips here, or at least for me, it wasn't a school trip, but my parents brought me here when I was, I think, 4 or 5 was my first trip to Washington, D.C. As kids, you have a certain impression of the memorial. What do you think it's important for adults to know about the Abraham Lincoln Memorial?
Well, for kids, a lot of times the first thing that they notice about the memorial is just how big it is.
That's what I remember. How huge it is.
Bigger he is above, towering over them, and sometimes that can make a very big impression. But for adults, too, even that, they don't realize how big of a memorial this is. They come here and they're like, wow.
How many feet tall?
The statue is 19 feet tall, and so if he stood, he'd be a lot taller. He was 6'3" in real life, a little over 6'3". So the statue is not life size, but so still, he was very impressive in size in real life. And so as he remains in memorial shape, he still is impressive. And so adults and children, they take that away, that, wow, he's so big.
I imagine it's a relief that you're open to celebrate President Lincoln's birthday because you were shut during the shutdown. What special things happen at the Lincoln Memorial on President Lincoln's birthday?
On his birthday, we have a celebration. A military band come and perform, and there's a wreath-laying ceremony where dozens of organizations and associations from all over the country, military, patriotic, Lincoln-related, they come and they lay a special wreath in honor of President Lincoln. And we're just here to honor the legacy of President Lincoln.
Why is it important there is this Lincoln Memorial here over the National Mall in our nation's capital?
The Lincoln Memorial, since its dedication in 1922, has become one of the top five destinations of all the National Park units in the whole National Park system. So there are over 400 units within the National Park Service, and the Lincoln Memorial on its own is in the top five of most visited sites. And I think because it is in the heart of Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, that it brings the millions of people who come here every year. They're coming to Washington, D.C. anyway, school trip, family trip, political trip, whatever reason brings them here to Washington, D.C. And so the Lincoln Memorial has become, they have to come here. This has become the one place they have to visit when they're in Washington, D.C., because it is like the jewel of the National Mall and of Washington, D.C.
Thanks to National Park Service Ranger Heidi Dietz, who, by the way, isn't from Illinois, but close, Wisconsin, for that tour. In studio now with me here at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. is Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy. He represents Illinois' 8th congressional district that covers parts of Chicago's west and northwest suburbs, including Schaumburg and Arlington Heights. Congressman, welcome back to the 21st. It's nice to be here with you in person.
It's great to be here, Nyla. Thank you.
So I want to start with the big news of the day, which is the news this morning. There's been a tentative agreement congressional leadership has reached to avoid another government shutdown, which would have happened or will happen on Friday if you guys don't figure out a spending plan. At issue, of course, is funding for President Trump's so-called border wall, and he originally wanted $5 billion. This deal reportedly includes about $1 billion. Do you think that's a good compromise?
I think that, first of all, thanks for having me on. I think that it's always a good thing when there's a bicameral and bipartisan agreement. So the Senate and the House appropriators, as well as the senior appropriators from both parties. Appropriators are actually the people who actually sign off on spending in Congress. When they come to an agreement, that's a big deal. And so I'm hopeful that the president blesses it, so to speak, because we can't afford another shutdown. In the last shutdown, which lasted 35 days, not only did 800,000 federal workers go without pay during that time, but millions of people went without services, essential services. We can't afford that situation again. I introduced a bill with Congressman Mitchell, a Republican of Michigan, called the Shutdown Shutdowns Bill. And I'd like to see that pass because I believe that shutdowns as a negotiating tool should be taken off the table. But in the interim, I hope that we can come to terms on this agreement that was arrived at last night.
And what would you say the mood is like in Washington today? Do you think people are hopeful about an agreement?
I think they're hopeful, but it's tense. I think that last time we thought that we had a deal, we were all very, very surprised when the president first said yes and then said no. And then then we went into a shutdown, which lasted a very, very long time.
You're on the House Oversight Committee, which Democrats took leadership over once the House won a majority. What's the number one priority of the Oversight Committee these days? There's a lot going on.
There's a lot. Obviously, we want to serve as a check and balance on the administration and at the same time try to get some things done. With regard to acting as a check and balance, you have to understand, you probably already know this, that none of the agencies of the federal government had much oversight in the last 2 years. In some ways, it felt like the president's Republican allies, especially in the House, acted as a rubber stamp on practically everything that the president did. And so we basically are starting oversight of this administration in this month. I'm hopeful that we can do it in a fair way, a reasonable way, and hopefully even a bipartisan way. At the same time we do that, we have to get certain things done. We have to deliver on pocketbook priorities of the American people. One of the things that I'll be championing is prescription drug price reform. As you know, drug prices are going through the roof. And at this time, I think that even Republicans want to come to the table and do a deal.
I wanted to ask you to that pocketbook issue about the AI Jobs Act. I know you just reintroduced that. That was something that was you tried last year and it's just been reintroduced. This would require the Department of Labor to issue a report looking at some of these more new economy jobs. And I wonder if you feel like right now, is the federal government, is the Department of Labor prepared for these technological shifts that we're facing with our economy?
I'm not sure. I think that artificial intelligence is becoming this technology that's pervasive in the economy. And unless we get our arms around it, we will either be a slave to it. In other words, it might end up in a lot of downsizing and layoffs and so forth, or we can make it a tool to make us more productive. And hopefully that makes us more prosperous. But we have to start with understanding what the impact of artificial intelligence is on the economy, and that is what the AI Jobs Act does. It's a bipartisan bill. 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats introduced it last term. We're going to do it again, and hopefully it passes.
Representative Raja Krishnamurthy is in studio with me here. He represents Illinois' 8th Congressional District. And I wonder how much of your job you think is to try to hold this current administration accountable. And I think we tend to think it's big things like the border wall or oversight with all on the oversight committee with all of these investigations like Mueller or FBI or the FBI. But I wonder how different government agencies are preparing for things like the changing economy that don't get as much attention. Do you see that as equally important?
Absolutely. Obviously, we know about some of the scandals and the abuses and the more high-profile investigations. But at the same time, as you said, we have to prepare for incredible changes that are happening in the economy and make sure that the American people are equipped with the tools to deal with them. So I think that hopefully we can approach some of those issues on a bipartisan way.
I wonder how much of you think that's been lost because there's so much like the whole first month of this new term was a shutdown and everyone was focusing on that. Was other business like this happening?
Not really. I think that in the last 2 years, we haven't seen enough attention to these types of issues. And now hopefully if we can get past some of these shutdowns and so forth, we can actually maybe even work together to deal with some of these very pressing problems.
Congressman, there's been a lot of incidents involving racism and bigotry within the Democratic Party for the past week or so. And you were among the majority of Democrats who have called, for example, for Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's resignation. Yesterday, I saw you said that Representative Ilhan Omar's tweets over the weekend, which have been called anti-Semitic. I know you said they were insensitive and wrong. I wonder if you think it's a good thing that lawmakers are being called out on this stuff immediately, whether it's something that happened decades ago in the case of Governor Northam or just this past weekend.
I think so. I think that if we are going to be critical of President Trump, who has been incredibly inflammatory in his remarks, you know, calling people on both sides of the Charlottesville hate rally, good people, or doing any number of things to denigrate immigrants or Muslim Americans or others. We have to do that to anybody who practices any type of prejudice or engages in any type of bigotry. So I think it's good to have the same standard for everybody.
And I'm speaking of these racist incidents, I wanted to bring everyone's attention to a hate crime people may not have heard about, and that was the vandalism of the Swami Narayan Temple in Louisville, Kentucky recently. And I know you issued a statement about this, not just on behalf of that temple, but for the broader Hindu community. And I wonder if you feel like hate crimes, when they happen against particularly South Asians or Asian Americans, don't get talked about or reported as much.
Well, that's a good point. I think that unfortunately, in this time when we've seen a rise in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, we're also seeing a rise in hate crimes against everybody who are, you know, otherwise characterized as the other, so to speak. You know, whether they're Hindus or Sikh people or Jains, or others, Chinese Americans, Asian Americans, who unfortunately sometimes feel the stigma associated with some of the remarks that the president makes about East Asian people. I think that we have to band together, okay? We have to band together against Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, homophobia, and hate of all kinds. And if there's a silver lining in any of what's happened in the last 2 years, I'm seeing a greater push in all communities to join together against hate directed at anyone.
I'm wondering if we can end on a more lighter note and ask,
okay,
as you have been here in Washington, what do you miss most about Illinois when you're here?
Well, my family. You know, I've got a wife and three little children. But in addition to that, I miss, you know, one of the things that we should be very proud of in Illinois is our people. We have some of the most hardworking, talented, but down-to-earth people you'll ever meet. And sometimes when you're in Washington, D.C., you get kind of caught up in the, you know, who's up, who's down, and that general political mentality, which unfortunately paralyzes the place. And it's so nice to see people from Illinois come out here, because I think they also bring a fresh perspective. And when I go back home, I certainly hear their perspectives left, right, and center. And I'm very glad that that happens.
Well, thanks for taking the time to come down and speak with us. It's Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy. He represents a Democrat representing Illinois' 8th District, covering parts of Chicago's west and northwest suburbs, including Schaumburg. Thank you for being with
me. Thank you, Nyla. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Stay tuned. Coming up after the break, you will hear more of The 21st live from NPR in Washington, D.C.
Support comes from Prairie Melody Premium Black Oil Sunflower Bird Seed. Prairie Melody is locally grown, supporting farms in transition to organic production. Information about local retail outlets and more at prairiemelodybirdseed.com/blog. Prairie Melody, it's all about the birds and the bees.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and if you're just joining us, we're broadcasting for the rest of the week from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Last month, 89 new members of the House of Representatives were sworn into office. It's way up from 52 new House members in 2017. Many of these new members are part of a wave that led to Democrats retaking control of the chamber, and one of those new representatives is Sean Casten. He defeated Republican Peter Roskam in Illinois' 6th Congressional District, which covers some of Chicago's west and northwest suburbs, including Wheaton, Elgin, and Downers Grove. I had a chance to speak with Congressman Casten earlier this morning for the very first time since he officially took office. Congressman Casten, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nyla.
So this is the first time with us as officially as a member of Congress. I wanted just to start by asking, what is it like to have a new job away from home and family a couple of days a week to be here in Washington?
You know, it's bittersweet. You got to start with the sweet part of actually, you know, leaving Cannon and seeing my office, if I can call it that, across the street. You know, and walking in and, you know, being on a first-name basis with John Lewis. These are, how do you put that into words? I certainly can't. Having said that, I got two daughters who, you know, I get to see on weekends now. And they think my job is pretty cool and they're excited and we talk. But I miss them. It's tough, but it's the, you take the good, you take the bad, and then you find out that you have the facts of life, I guess.
What kind of advice are you getting from other congressmen that have been around maybe a little bit longer than you have? More than 30 days, let's put it that way.
So lots of advice, most good. I'll tell you just my favorite one because it just made me laugh. I'd mentioned John Lewis. He told me early on that he said one of the last votes of the week is the journal, where you basically vote, you know, whether you accept the minutes of the House as written. And Mr. Lewis said to me, he goes, always vote against the journal because leadership always votes for it and you'll boost your score of voting against leadership.
These are little things that you don't know until you come here. So
a couple weeks later, the vote on the journal's on the floor, and I see him standing down in front. So I walk down and I put my card in the machine, and I lean to him and I said, "You know, a wise man once told me to always vote against the journal," and I press no. And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, I voted for it today."
Oh, no. It's like you're getting hazed. On a serious note, I wonder what it was like to come to work on your first day with the government being shut down.
Yeah. Look, there's a part of me that it makes me just really angry, because here we are. You know, you run for office because you have ideas about how to govern. And we spent 35 days, well, in my case, 22 days, but 35 days in aggregate, essentially arguing about whether we should govern. And it's frustrating. I'm glad it's done. I hope the news this morning bears out that this is, you know, done in a more serious way. I haven't been briefed by the delegation yet. The silver lining in it is that to come on the first day and you've got staff you've just hired who you haven't all, like, figured out who you are yet. You've just lost all your campaign staff who you know really well. And you're running to the floor with a piece of paper that says, "Here's our vote recommendations on the bills on the floor." The fact that every single vote was a no-brainer, open the government, open the government, open the government, open the government, meant we could kind of learn each other, you know, learn about each other and get to know each other a little bit before we might have had, in a different environment, something where we're saying, "Wait a minute, I know that you might think I would like this, but I actually on the campaign I said something very different. I have to be careful." So there was a silver lining in coming up to speed, but it's a small drop of lemonade out of a large pile of lemons.
And but you, as you did mention, there was news last night. There is a tentative agreement to avoid another government shutdown, which would have happened this Friday. From the reports that we've seen, the deal would include $1.375 billion for 55 miles of fence along the border. According to the Washington Post this morning, House Speaker Pelosi has signed off on it. I know you haven't said, is this something you think in principle you would support?
I certainly hope so. And I want to, you know, I want to look at it. On an objective basis, the things that we need to be doing for border security, number one is keep the government open, because when we don't pay our border agents, that's a problem. Number two, I find myself thinking that a lot of the rhetoric that comes from the president about the border is based on a view of Mexico that's informed by old spaghetti westerns, that somehow this is just all open desert and donkeys. Really addressing border security means recognizing that, you know, most of the things that we don't want to come into our country comes through ports of entry, and those things need to be beefed. That's a customs agent, not a border patrol agent question. We should really acknowledge that the overwhelming majority of undocumented immigrants in this country today are visa overstays, not border crossings. That's a much harder conversation, because that's really a civil liberties conversation, not a let's build a wall conversation. In speaking with members who, you know, are in border districts, people like Xochitl Torres Small, I trust their judgment that there are needs to bolster the wall in some places, but that this is really a more holistic question of saying, how should we deal with this in a larger sense? And that, speaking only to the dollar value that's talked about, that's pretty consistent with what I think a lot of smart people have been saying is appropriate for wall versus other things.
My guest is one of the newest members of Illinois' congressional delegation, Congressman Sean Casten. And before you were here in Congress, you were the CEO of a clean energy company. And I wanted to ask you about the Green New Deal that was announced last week. First of all, were you involved with this?
I wasn't involved at all.
What do you think of it, the broad outlines of it?
I think it's being described as a policy document, when in reality it's an outline of social outcomes. It's a document that describes a lot of socially nice things that I think a lot of us would probably support. We desperately need to lower CO2 emissions. I'm delighted it's causing that conversation. We need to have a conversation about the hollowing out of manufacturing jobs and middle-class jobs, and maybe it triggers that conversation. We need to have conversations about wealth inequality. I don't understand particularly how it actually coheres together into a whole as a policy document. And I do have some frustration, because if you believe, as I do, that the top three most pressing issues on our species right now are climate change, then I think, at least in my view, I conclude a couple things. Number one, we need to pass laws today that are going to meaningfully reduce CO2 emissions. Not talk about laws, not talk about policies. We need to pass laws. Number two, we need to recognize what became painfully obvious to me in 20 years in the space, we suffer from a lot of unintended consequences of well-intentioned energy and environmental policy. We have a lot of policies that reward people for making money at the expense of the environment. We have a lot of policies that reward people for protecting the environment at the expense of the economy. We have almost no policies that reward people for growing the economy and lowering CO2 emissions. And having spent 20 years running companies with missions to profitably reduce CO2 emissions, I cannot tell you how many times the barrier to us doing more of that was actually a United States law. I think for too long, the pro-business community and the pro-environmental community has been at loggerheads with each other and has worked on under the shared assumption that you cannot decouple economic growth from CO2 emissions growth. And that's just wrong. The United States uses more than twice as much fossil fuel per dollar of GDP, total energy per dollar of GDP, as Switzerland, Germany, Denmark. If all we did was adapt what the policies that those countries have done, who have pretty good access to talent and people and capital, we could slash CO2 emissions and grow the economy.
We actually got a question from a listener about this, and I wanted to end with just that question. It is about fossil fuels. We let everybody know that we're coming to Washington, mm-hmm. and so they were, and who we were interviewing. And Ron wanted to say, please ask our legislators, why are we still subsidizing fossil fuels? Would they write a bill to cut or end them?
To some degree, we can break these into two separate issues. You can put penalties on the release on the use of fossil fuels. You can put incentives on the use of clean energy. Sometimes those things are the same. Sometimes they're not the same. But the pacing question really has to be, how do you get the CO2 down? I'm frustrated as much as anybody with the subsidies to fossil fuels and the unlevel playing field, but I'm encouraged by the fact that every time we build a clean energy asset, you use that asset all the time. And so as much as there are, in fact, subsidies that make it hard for some of those technologies to come forward, the pacing item is the deployment of capital for those assets, not once they're operated, will they run. What's critical is that we get them built, because if all you do is reduce those other subsidies and you don't actually figure out what is the barrier to deploying this capital, then you're not going to get those assets forward. It's one of the reasons why, in addition to being on the Climate Select Committee, I'm delighted to be on the Financial Services Committee and specifically the capital markets. Pick any capital-intensive commodity sector of the U.S. economy. We're really not building that infrastructure right now.
Congressman Sean Casten represents Illinois' 6th congressional district, part of Chicago's west and northwest suburbs, including Wheaton, Elgin, Downers Grove. Representative, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
I spoke with Representative Casten earlier this morning, and you can hear the entire extended version of our conversation online. Head to 21stshow.org. Of course, February 12th is Lincoln's birthday, a big day for the state of Illinois. Earlier in the hour, you heard our tour of the Lincoln Memorial, one of the most visited landmarks in the country. But not a lot of people know about another historic Lincoln site. It's his cottage in a quiet northwest part of Washington, where you can not just walk through the actual spaces where the Lincoln family spent their summers, but you'll also be guided through stories that reveal how Lincoln's ideas still affect us today. I spoke with Executive Director and CEO Aaron Carlson Mast and Senior Museum Program Associate Joan Cummins. And while it was just a quick trip for us from NPR in downtown D.C., I asked Joan Cummins about how President Lincoln made that trip back in the 1860s. So we took a journey up here from downtown Washington, not too far from the White House, and it took about half an hour. Would that have been how long President Lincoln would have taken, gone by horseback, I assume?
Yeah, mostly solo on horseback. We do think it took about a half hour to, it's 3 miles, more or less, from here to the White House.
And Aaron, what was the idea of this cottage? This was a getaway for President Lincoln and for his family?
Yes, so the whole Lincoln family moved out here, and we know that it's tempting to think that Lincoln was taking himself out here to get away from work and everything else that was stressing him out at the time. But we know that, in fact, by coming here, he was bringing himself closer to the war and its human cost.
And how close?
So, for example, the cottage is only 200 yards away from the First National Cemetery. So that first summer the Lincolns are living here, over 1,000 soldiers are buried in plain view. And it's only a mile and a half south of Fort Stevens, where the Confederates attacked in 1864.
And so was this cottage a safe place for the president during the war?
Well, we know that the first summer that they were living here, they were on their own, essentially, as a family with household staff. And it's not until the end of the summer that Lincoln is assigned a formal presidential guard. He was the first president to have a security detail like that. And it was because of threats against his safety.
Joan, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what this place looked like when President Lincoln was here?
Yeah, so it's a Gothic Revival cottage. It has 34 rooms, so two floors, attic, and a basement. It's a big house, and it's built specifically to be cool and comfortable in a DC summer. I'm going to open for you one of the jib doors that leads out onto the south veranda of the cottage. It looks like a normal window, and then there are two panels below the window that open and close like this.
Oh, wow, and you really do feel the temperature difference right away. And Aaron, this room that we're in, so the whole idea of this house was meant to be a retreat, but as you all said, the reality was it's not like President Lincoln was really able to escape his work.
That's right, nor did he really seem to want to. Work was really an ever-present part of his life during the Civil War and his presidency. You know, we often think of the president in terms of a lack of accessibility nowadays, you know, constantly being protected. It's very difficult to come and get an audience with the president now. In Lincoln's time, it was fairly simple to try to get an audience with the president. The fact that he was coming out here in the evening did not stop people.
So, Joan, this was actually a room that President Lincoln would have entertained people who would have come to visit.
Yeah, we talk about it as the parlor, and there's one specific visitor who came up to speak to Lincoln whose story we tell in this room. His name was Colonel Scott. He was in the Union Army, and he had lost his wife in a boating accident. And he came up to ask Lincoln for some help in retrieving her body. Scott's very upset. Lincoln replied in this way.
Am I to have no rest? Is there no hour or spot when or where I may escape this constant call? Why do you follow me out here with such business as this? Why do you not go to the War Office, where they have charge of these matters? Don't you know, Colonel Scott, that we are in the midst of war, that suffering and death press upon all of us?
Scott's had an extremely difficult thing happen and is just looking for some help. And Lincoln is dealing with his own personal tragedy as well as the responsibility of carrying the weight of the big picture of all of the bad things that are happening. And I think it's very human to get to the end of a day and not want to talk to whoever the next person is who has a problem for you. And I really appreciate the reminder of Lincoln the person in there inside Lincoln the president. And then there's a little more to the story. Lincoln followed up with Scott the next morning.
My dear Colonel, I was a brute last night. I have no excuse for my conduct. I've had a regretful night. Now, my good man, hurry and get ready. I have seen Secretary Stanton and he has arranged all. I have my carriage here and will go with you to the wharf. And, Colonel, when you get home, don't tell your children of my conduct last night.
And how do we know all of this happened? Did he write a letter?
So there's a journalist who was accompanying Scott who had sort of clued Scott in that this is where he could find Lincoln. And the journalist recounted it in a book that he was writing.
I'm here with Aaron Carlson Mast, who's the CEO of President Lincoln's Cottage. And we're also here with tour guide Joan Cummins. This is actually a really unusual historical site in D.C. because this actually isn't run by the Parks Department.
That's right. We're the only national monument in the entire country that is not federally funded.
So, Joan, where now are we in President Lincoln's library?
We're in the room that the Lincolns were using as a library while they were here in the cottage. You can see up top there over on the wall and also on the other wall there, the horizontal lines where you can see the bookshelves used to be. You probably know already reading was a huge part of Lincoln's life. It was something how he had educated himself. But he liked to tell stories, especially when trying to explain something to a group of other people. There's one story in particular he told to explain how he was seeing the people around him talk about liberty. Lincoln said, Americans all declare for liberty, but when we say that, we don't all mean the same thing. And so he told this story to talk about that. It's about a sheep, a wolf, and a shepherd. So the shepherd stops the wolf from eating the sheep. The sheep looks at the shepherd and says, thank you, you're a liberator, you have given me my freedom. And the wolf looks at the shepherd and says, you are a tyrant, you have taken away my freedom. Lincoln said, the sheep and the wolf cannot agree on a definition of the word liberty, and precisely the same difference prevails today among us human creatures. So he's using the story as a way of talking about the people he saw around him and the fact that the people who owned slaves, the wolf, and the people who were enslaved, the sheep, were both using the word liberty to talk about what they wanted. And for me, that really resonates with my experience of living in a democracy, and that people can have the same very big scale principles in mind and extremely different ideas about how to get there on the ground. Part of Lincoln's task living here at the cottage, especially in the summer of 1862, as he was developing the Emancipation Proclamation, was to be the shepherd, to make decisions about whose freedom and when, and how we were going to move forward as a society that could not agree on this issue.
That's Joan Cummins from President Lincoln's Cottage in Washington, D.C. We made the visit as part of our celebration of President Lincoln's birthday, and we'll continue that conversation after a quick break here on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're broadcasting today from NPR headquarters in D.C., and you've been listening to a little bit of our visit to President Lincoln's Cottage. That's a National Historic Registry site in Washington. Let's continue our discussion with Executive Director and CEO Aaron Carlson Mast and Museum Program Associate Joan Cummins. Here, Joan's telling us about the seeds of thinking that were the foundation for the Emancipation Proclamation. It was at this cottage that Lincoln began to think seriously about how to pen this proclamation, and eventually where he wrote it, in his bedroom, in fact. But first, we went to the library.
And so this is where we actually see the germs of all of these ideas that actually became reality, which do lead to the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm. And Lincoln went looking to the existing founding documents for answers on this question, but he found incompatibility there as well. The sheep and the wolf cannot both get what they want. And he went to the Declaration of Independence, has this big, beautiful idea that people have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Constitution upholds the right to property in the form of enslaved people, has a couple other protections for the institution of slavery throughout as well. But Lincoln saw those as incompatible as well, and it was his job to try and figure out how to get those incompatible things to line up with each other again. For a long time, it seemed like that would be an impossible problem to solve. So in a moment, as we go upstairs, we'll be using the same banister and the same steps that Lincoln used. I like to imagine him closing his book here in the library, turning the gas light down, and walking upstairs to bed in his slippers. I don't know if you've ever gone to bed thinking about a problem that felt impossible, but if you have, you know a little bit about what that's like.
So, Joan, this is the room.
Yeah, as best we know, right? This is the room Lincoln was using as his bedroom while he was here, and it's also the room where he came up with the Emancipation Proclamation. A lot of times people ask, like, well, did it really do anything? Lincoln's not on the ground in South Carolina. What can he possibly be doing about it? And the answer is in large part that it's the people who were enslaved who took themselves out from under Confederate control as best they could. And they began to do that pretty much as soon as they heard about it.
How many people are we talking about?
The entire group of people that the proclamation officially applied to is 4 million people. 50,000 is the estimate of people who were able to get free right there on January 1st. The last group of enslaved people to find out about the proclamation didn't find out until June of 1865, after they'd been officially free for about 2.5 years.
So, Aaron, when we think about this place and the fact that we are standing in this room right now where President Lincoln created all of these ideas, I wonder, this is an interesting museum in that you have a space that doesn't necessarily have a lot of historical artifacts, but where you're sort of sharing President Lincoln's ideas. And I wonder, as you think about the Emancipation Proclamation, we have 200 years, two centuries removed from that. And I wonder about what ideas you think are really important that still need to be conveyed.
When we set out to create the cottage, we thought, well, what's the most important thing about Lincoln's time here? And it's the ideas he created in these spaces. This is a real powerful place that Lincoln used to move our country forward. But we also acknowledge that that work is unfinished. And so we are committed to keeping the cottage that home for brave ideas today. And that comes through in the tours every single day with our visitors, and also through a lot of our special programs, including Students Opposing Slavery, which is an international youth abolitionist program that we have. Having this space for Lincoln was nation-changing and changed his life, and we think that the best and highest purpose of the cottage today is to continue that work.
Oh, thank you so much for taking us through this tour. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you've been listening to The 21st, broadcasting live from NPR headquarters in Washington. We've also been speaking with members of Illinois' congressional delegation. We heard earlier from Democratic members Raja Krishnamurthy and Sean Kasten, and I'm joined now by Republican Congressman Darren LaHood. He represents 19 counties that make up Illinois' 18th congressional district, including parts of Peoria, Bloomington Normal, Springfield, stretching all the way west to the Missouri border, and as he's been reminding me, was Lincoln's congressional district. Congressman LaHood, welcome back to The 21st. It's nice to have you here in person.
Well, thank you. Great to be with you and your listeners today.
And so remind us what Lincoln's congressional district was.
Yeah, well, very proud to represent Lincoln's congressional district. So 1847 to 1849, Abraham Lincoln served one term in Congress. He represented nine counties in central and west central Illinois. And I'm very proud that I represent those nine counties. And he's buried in our congressional district in Oak Ridge Cemetery. So when people ask me about my district here in Washington, D.C., I love telling people I represent the Lincoln congressional district.
So let's fast forward to 2019, and let me ask you about the big news last night, which is that leaders of both parties have agreed in principle to an agreement that would avoid another government shutdown. So this includes $1.375 billion for 55 miles of border fencing, President Trump's so-called wall that he's been advocating for. Do you support this deal?
Well, I still need to know the details on it. We just got back to D.C. last night. I know the agreement was reached this morning. The details are still coming out. We'll have an opportunity tonight and tomorrow to look at the specifics. I want to read the bill. I want to know what's in it. Obviously, I've had concerns all along about how we secure our border. I've heard from lots of people in my district on wanting to secure the border, make sure that we have adequate barriers along the Mexico-U.S. border to do that. So I'm anxious to see those details and make a decision. However, I will say this, we got to make sure that we don't have another government shutdown again and work to make sure we keep the government functioning. I worry about what that does to our economy and what it does to the state of Illinois.
And I wonder what you think the effect of the shutdown had. I'm thinking, for example, the Peoria Ag Lab is in your district. That was shut down for the entire shutdown, correct?
It was. And I've been a strong advocate for the Ag Lab. It does tremendous work. Our researchers, our PhDs, our scientists there that not only work on food safety for Illinois, but for the entire country. So those 180, 190 employees there, we want to make sure that they are not without pay and they can continue to do the great work that they do. And also our TSA agents that work at our airports.
Representative LaHood, of course, our listeners know that your father served in the House for 14 years and then was also Transportation Secretary under President Obama. I wonder if you think the election of President Trump and his administration has made it more difficult to work across party lines?
Well, I think you can look at it a couple different ways. Some people will say, well, we have a much more polarized atmosphere in Washington, D.C. I would say a couple things. If you look at the last Congress, we passed criminal justice reform. You know, I spent 10 years as a state and federal prosecutor, been very engaged in this space. And we passed at the end of last year, bipartisan bill. You had conservatives and you had liberals came together for the good of the country. I think that's a good example. President Trump signed that. Good example of bipartisanship. Career technical education, worked on that last year in a bipartisan way. Opioid legislation. So, I mean, I think those are three monumental bills in legislation we passed last year that was done in a bipartisan way. It doesn't mean we don't have challenges. Clearly we do. There's lots more bipartisan work that can be done on infrastructure, workforce development. Trade is a big issue that I've been a strong proponent of. So, we tend to focus on the negative sometimes and the partisanship, but we've had some good examples of bipartisanship and working together.
To that point about the economy, I want to ask you about the Green New Deal that some Democratic members of Congress unveiled last week. We were talking to Representative Kasten about this earlier, but supporters of this Green New Deal say that the federal government needs to commit resources to curbing climate change on the same scale that we devoted resources during, for example, World War II. And I wonder if you think climate change is as much of a threat to the U.S. as a similar scale as World War II was.
Well, I wouldn't put myself in that category. And to be honest, I have real concerns about the Green Deal. I know the details have not been released yet. I think people are anxiously awaiting that. But from what I've seen, you know, I have concerns about what that does to the economy. I think always you need to have a balance when it comes to protecting the environment, but also realize that, you know, there's a balance between what we do in our energy sector, and we don't want to curtail jobs or curtail. We have the best economy we've had in 40 years in terms of low unemployment, in terms of jobs, in terms of private sector wages going up. We want to keep that going. I guess when I look at energy production or I look at the environment, I look at a kind of a all of the above approach, you know, where we can continue to use fossil fuels, we should. Solar, wind, alternative energy, we should look at all those things. And I think we are now independently, we have energy independence in this country. And I think it's because of that, all of the above approach. My district, for instance, has the largest amount of wind of any congressional district in the state of Illinois. We have a
You can always see if you're on 55 or 57, right?
Exactly. And we're proud of that, right? And solar, I think, is a burgeoning technology, and it's growing in Illinois. So, you know, figuring out from a competitive standpoint and from a free market standpoint, that's really what I look at in this, and how you balance that. I always get concerned too when we want to enter into these global agreements. You know, we have not been able to hold the Chinese or the or India or a number of Pakistan, a number of these third world countries accountable for polluting the environment. I think we need to have more enforcement mechanism on that to hold those bad actors accountable. I think the U.S. has done a wonderful job in terms of technology, in terms of modernization, in terms of the all above, all of the above energy approach. And companies have been very, again, creative and I think without government intervention with making those changes that are needed.
I wanted to ask you about, speaking of all of this, you've been pushing for an extension to the biodiesel tax credit, which was established back in 2005. And why do you think biofuel should still receive a tax credit?
Well, again, I think it falls into that category. Similar to what we have done with wind, similar to what we've done with solar, we want to get these energy sources to the point where they're competitive. And I think the biodiesel tax credit has been extremely beneficial to our farmers in West Central Illinois. And by the way, a lot of bipartisan support on that. I just did a letter with Democrat from Iowa, Dave Loebsack, on this. We had about 50 members of the congressional of the House on there, Republicans and Democrats. But we believe biodiesel is good for the environment. It's good for our agriculture sector. And I think it's provided us more energy independence when we think about our dependence on foreign oil.
My guest is Representative Darren LaHood. He's a Republican representing Illinois' 18th congressional district, which includes parts of Peoria, Bloomington Normal, and Springfield. You mentioned China earlier, and you were chair of the U.S.-China Working Group. And you also, as you mentioned, of course, represent a district that's heavily affected by trade with China. I feel like Americans have been asking this question for a long time, but do you see China as an adversary, as a friend? You know, you were just mentioning pollution, something in between.
Listen, I think we are independent, or we are interdependent on each other. China's economy and our economy, we have to work together. And I kind of look at our relationship with China. It's kind of like the stock market. It kind of goes up and it goes down, and it goes up and it goes down. And there's some good things about it, and there's some not so good things about it. And we're seeing that right now with the trade war with China. You know, what we're trying to change is the behavior that China has engaged in really for the last 25 years. And I give President Trump a lot of credit on this. China has been ripping us off in a lot of ways when it comes to intellectual property, when it comes to forced technology transfers, when it comes to stealing our military secrets. And really no president from President Clinton to President Bush to President Obama has been able to do anything about it. To make China abide by the same rules that we abide by in this country and every other Western democracy does around the world.
Jason, we're probably going to go straight to short credit, too.
To change. I'm not a fan of tariffs. I think tariffs are taxes. They're taxes on consumers. They hurt our agriculture commodities. And so I've been critical of President Trump implementing tariffs, particularly based on national security. I think that's a flawed policy, and it's hurt our commodities. Specifically related to, tariffs and
you're thinking about soy in particular,
corn and soybeans, and the retaliations have been done by China. But we are now in the midst of negotiation. We have a team going over to China next week. We have to end this trade war and get back to a trade agreement there. But we now have their attention. The China stock market's down because of the tariffs. Their economy's sliding a little bit. So we have to figure out how we reach an agreement with them that's good for agriculture, that's good for our manufacturing, and holds China accountable. So my work on the U.S.-China Working Group has been extremely beneficial, and we hope that we're going to reach a good compromise here with the Chinese, but something that holds them accountable, puts enforcement mechanisms in there so that they abide by the same rules that all of us have to.
We're almost out of time. One last quick question for you. I wonder what you miss most about Illinois when you're here in Washington, other than your family, of course.
Well, you know, I miss common sense, right? I tell people I go back to Peoria, Illinois every weekend just to stay grounded, right? And West Central Illinois has hardworking people. Most of them have a lot of common sense. And, staying in touch with them is vitally important to doing this job in Washington, D.C.
That's Congressman Darren LaHood, who represents Illinois' 18th Congressional District, a Republican. Representative LaHood, thanks for taking the time to come down to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be hearing from Senator Dick Durbin, and we're going to be sitting down with one of the leaders of the National Science Foundation about how the government shutdown has affected scientific research. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to Emily Dagger, Natasha Branch, and Kevin Waite from NPR for all their help this week. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to 21stshow.org for more information. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.